We all have those pieces in our closet that we reach for again and again. Quince gets that, and they've built their brand around it. They make elevated everyday essentials. Think washable silk, organic cotton, and 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters that start at just $50. I already know I'll be living in their cashmere crewneck this fall. It's soft, it fits perfectly, and it goes with everything I own. Beyond cozy knitwear, Quince has incredible stretch denim, leather bags, and timeless gold jewelry to pull your whole outfit together. The best part is that everything is priced 50 to 80% less than comparable high-end brands. They do this by partnering directly with ethical factories and cutting out traditional retail markups. They even bring that same direct-to-consumer luxury approach to home goods, like hotel-quality bedding and beautiful bath linens. Find the fall pieces you'll reach for most at Quince. Download the Quince app for app-exclusive offers or go to quince.com/campus. Get free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada and the UK too. That's quince.com/campus.
The police closed my sister's case in 2019. Last month, her killer commented on my post.
On Reddit, true crime doesn't come from journalists. It comes from the victims, the witnesses, and sometimes the suspects themselves.
People post the things they'd never say out loud, anonymous, unfiltered, and completely real.
And every Tuesday on Crimes of Reddit, we read them out loud.
I'm Sabrina Deanna Roga from Two Girls, One Ghost.
And I'm Alexis Linkletter from The First Degree.
Each week, one of us brings the most unhinged true crime stories the internet has to offer.
And the other goes in completely blind. No prep, no spoilers, reacting in real time, same as you. And then we swap.
And we pull every thread until the whole twisted picture comes into view.
It's dark. It's messy. And the scariest part is that these are real stories, posted by real people.
New episodes drop every Tuesday. Listen to and follow Crimes of Reddit, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
The fourth, third, and second floors are filled. Stay downstairs.
On the afternoon of December 2nd, 1964, more than 1,000 people, including folk singer Joan Baez, began a sit-in inside Sproul Hall, the administration building on the campus of the University of California, Berkeley.
Leading up to the sit-in, we did a tremendous amount of organizing.
That's Bettina Aptaker, who you heard in part one.
Because it was not only nonviolence, it was that, but also what's happening on which floor, different things that were going to take place.
In part one, Bettina told a story of a couple sit-ins the free speech movement at Berkeley organized. Each one of these prior sit-ins was somewhat improvised. This time, they planned very deliberately.
There were classes that were held down in the basement of Sproul Hall. Michael Lerner, who was later to become a rabbi, did a whole Hanukkah celebration. On the fourth floor was the study hall, where you weren't supposed to talk so that people could study. The second floor was where everything was happening, because that's where we were. And Joni was there and so on.
Joni, as in Joan Baez, who Bettina and other organizers had convinced to join them. Pictures and videos from that day show hallways, stairwells, and rooms completely full of people. People with notebooks, homework, guitars, books. It was remarkably well organized. But of course, the administration and police had to respond.
Anyone who didn't want to be arrested was told to leave before 5 o'clock. Anyone who wasn't at least 18 years old, we wanted them to leave because we didn't want them to be put in a juvenile hall.
Word went out that police had closed off access to the building, meaning that all were welcome and encouraged to leave, but if they did, they could not re-enter. As the sit-in extended into the night, police and administrators became increasingly focused on ending the sit-in.
There was an incident on the second floor where the police came up and charged into a group of students who were sitting down on the floor, beating people with their batons, I guess you call it. And it's still not clear to me why they did that.
This time, FSM leaders were determined to wait it out. They would only leave with an agreement in hand or in handcuffs. I'm Ian Mont. This week on Campus Files, Bodies Upon the Gears, the Free Speech Movement of 1964, Part 2. Late into the night, students were singing, dancing, studying, teaching, and organizing as they took control of Sproul Hall, the main administration building on the campus of UC Berkeley. Around 11 p.m. that night, administrators held an emergency meeting to discuss how to respond.
About 3 o'clock in the morning, so this would have been the morning of December 3rd now, Edward Strong, who was the chancellor at that time of the Berkeley campus, got up on the second floor of Sproul Hall, where I could hear him holding a piece of paper.
I found a recording of the moment Bettina is describing.
May I have your attention, please? I am Dr. Edward Strong, Chancellor of the Berkeley campus. I have an announcement.
And he declared that the assembly was illegal and that we had materially affected the ability of the university to do its work, which was met with huge cheers, because that had been the point.
This assemblage has developed to such a point that the purpose and work of the university have been materially impaired.
And then he said he declared it an illegal assembly, which he had to do legally, and that if we didn't leave, we would be arrested. And of course, nobody left. And the arrest proceeded, and they started up, I think, on the fourth floor.
Each floor had a leader from the free speech movement coaching their floor on nonviolence. This is a short clip from a documentary called Berkeley in the 60s, where a protester describes what happened next.
So he was giving us a speech on what you do, how you go limp. And he was saying, now when the cops come at you, you don't want to fight them, you just want to go limp. And as he's saying this, the cops are coming at him. He talked all the way down to the floor, and I know this because I was looking between their legs. It was really an inspiration, and I said to myself, if he can do that, that's what I'm going to try to do. So when they got to me, they said, do you want to walk out like a lady, or are you going to get dragged out? And I said, I want to get dragged out like a lady.
You could hear people yelling. I mean, they dragged people down the stairs, sometimes their heads banging on the stairs, or dragged people by their clothing. Now, the other thing that should be said is that our lawyer, whose name was Robert Truhaft, was in the building in order to witness the arrests, and they arrested him, and that's illegal. They also put newspapers on the windows downstairs in the basement so that the press couldn't see in.
Because there were so many students, the arrests stretched on for hours. Each student was photographed and then either walked or dragged down the stairs to the basement, where they were processed and eventually loaded onto buses to a local jail.
I was arrested on Thursday morning about 9 o'clock on the second floor, although they hadn't come down to the second floor yet. They were still working on the third floor by then, but there was an officer there and he said, grab her, pointing to me, because they identified me as one of the leaders of the movement.
Bettina later wrote about her experience with police that day. Quote, after being photographed, I was dragged by the arm down the corridor and deposited in front of the elevator. A booted officer kicked me hard in the stomach. Doubled over, I crawled into the elevator. I walked out of the elevator, still holding my stomach. I was met by more officers. 2, one on each side, held me with my arms straight out, twisting my skin in opposite directions, while a third pummeled me in the stomach and breasts with his fists. End quote. Others recounted being assaulted by police officers while being arrested. Here's a reporter recounting some of what was happening.
They grabbed one kid and pushed him down the steps, beating him on the back of the head. It's a kind of gauntlet. They're kicking them and throwing them down the stairs. They're throwing them down the stairs and pushing them down the stairs out of the way. None of the kids that I've seen have fought back in any way whatsoever.
In total, 773 people were arrested, the largest peacetime arrest in U.S. history to that point.
There had been a kind of a lull in student activism in the 50s that called students then the silent generation. They were intimidated by McCarthyism.
That's Robert Cohen. Robert is a historian and professor at NYU. He's written about the free speech movement and social movements in the civil rights era. I wanted to talk to Robert because he could help put this story and especially this historic mass arrest in context. As he described it to me, young people in the post-World War II years, the generation right before Bettina and Mario Savio, were nicknamed the Silent Generation for, well, their silence. and the actions of this younger generation was head-turning.
So essentially what's happening is that the restrictions on speech are getting in the way of this increasingly activist generation. There's a kind of a challenge to this tradition of fear and sort of suppression of dissent. So basically what happened was there was a kind of an attempt to break down that fear from the McCarthy era and the apathy.
So when students organized like they were doing here, it was incredibly controversial. Students engaging in civil disobedience, obstructing police, going on strike, it all seemed extreme to the public. And until this point, the public was incredibly hostile to the movement. But the brutality and scale of the police response caused some, especially some faculty, to reevaluate.
Well, the importance of that was, in terms of the outcome, the faculty, remember the faculty who the administration really won over to some degree during those negotiations, they lost them because of the arrests.
The brutality of the arrests was, to many faculty, an incredibly embarrassing look for the campus.
So that really began to turn what, from the perspective of faculty, was, look, you can't sell this free speech area without the police invading the campus? What kind of leadership is that?
Most of the arrested students were taken to Santa Rita Rehab Center, a former internment camp for Japanese Americans during World War II. Students inside Santa Rita Jail were isolated from radio and phones for hours. When they were finally permitted to turn on the radio, they heard an announcer say that there was a 2-mile-long train of cars sitting outside Santa Rita. The cars were driven by faculty who were heading there to bail out students.
There was like a traffic jam of cars of faculty members going out in the middle of the night to bail out their students and bring them back from Santa Rita Jail.
By noon on Thursday, 24 hours after the big rally in front of Sproul Hall, faculty held an emergency meeting. They voted to condemn the actions of the administration and the governor of California, who had been involved in the arrests. They also voted to raise money to pay for bail. According to Bettina's book, some even put up their houses to cover bail. The tide had really and truly turned. Bettina was bailed out late on Thursday.
And when I got out of jail, I went to sleep because I was exhausted. I'd been up, I don't know how many days.
By this point, the administration had created a crisis for themselves. Just days earlier, the free speech movement was on its heels. Faculty support was minimal. Student support was waning. But now, all of that had changed.
By the time I got to campus on Friday, it was like at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and the campus was pretty much deserted. The graduate students had gone out on strike. Some faculty had joined them. Some faculty had written on their blackboards that they would not teach while police occupied the campus.
And while the broader public wasn't yet supportive of the protests, the tide was beginning to turn there too. 75 attorneys volunteered to defend the arrested students. Many unionized delivery drivers agreed to halt deliveries to campus. And the following week, the full faculty senate was scheduled for what was sure to be a pivotal meeting, which had UC Berkeley president Clark Kerr on edge.
Kerr realized that he was losing the faculty. In fact, the academic senate was talking about a resolution of no confidence in the chancellor after the mass arrests. So what's going on now is that Kerr is desperate. He wants to kind of, how can he get the faculty back on his side?
So President Kerr arranged a meeting with a small group of faculty, including the then chair of the academic senate. This small group worked out a settlement of sorts, nicknamed the Peace Plan. This settlement was arranged outside of standard channels and without involvement of the FSM. The administration chose to cancel all class on the following Monday and to call a convocation in the Greek Theater, inviting all on campus to gather to hear this issue settled once and for all. One newspaper would later dub this meeting the Tragedy in the Greek Theater. That's after the break.
It's Sophia with an F, Franklin with the Y, and if you're looking for some bubblegum dum-dum podcast, then you are in the wrong place, baby. Whether I'm reminiscing on the trials and tribulations of working in the corporate world to recapping today's latest reality TV show, you're going to want to pull up a chair and stick around. It's a good time and always 100% unfiltered. Follow and listen to Sophia with an F wherever you get your podcasts.
G'day, I'm Justin Wolfers, host of the Platypus Economics Podcast. If there's one thing I've learned from a career teaching economics, it's that your life is shaped by economic currents you'll never see. A single price tag can explain things 1,000 experts can't. People who understand economics, they make better decisions in their careers, their finances, their relationships, and their communities, and I want that for you. Listen to and follow Platypus Economics, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
At the Greek Theater, Kerr is trying to impose his compromise without letting any students speak, including Mario, have this huge meeting, no classes, on December 7th, and then in this huge amphitheater in the hills of Berkeley to try to settle this controversy.
UC Berkeley President Clark Kerr had arranged a major gathering at the Greek Theater, an amphitheater on campus with capacity to seat more than 8,000 people. And for this meeting, it's well over capacity. Ahead of the meeting, Mario and Bettina attempted to make contact with President Kerr.
Before his speech and before everything started, Mario and I went backstage and we talked to Robert Scalapino, who was the chair of the Academic Senate.
Scalapino was one of the people involved in Kerr's proposed settlement and was not friendly to the FSM.
We asked for permission for Mario to simply make an announcement that following Kerr's speech, whatever it was going to be, the free speech movement would hold a rally in Sproul Hall Plaza. That's all we wanted to say. And we asked permission, and Scalapino said no. As we walked off the stage, there were thousands of people already in the Greek Theater because it was just before the thing was going to begin. They started to applaud. It was clear that they had recognized Mario, and it was clear what their feelings were.
Here's audio from Kerr's speech that day.
The departmental chairman believe that the acts of civil disobedience on December 2nd and 3rd were unwarranted and that they obstruct rational and fair consideration of the grievances brought forward by the students. There are a small number of individuals, I regret to say, who are interested in fomenting a crisis merely for the sake of crisis. They hope that continuing chaos will bring about a total revolution and their own particular concept of utopia.
And in his speech, he said that the students would not be disciplined, that there would be no disciplinary action against those who had been arrested in the sit-in of December 2nd. But he again refused to budge on the issue of advocacy that I explained before.
So essentially, Kerr gathered the campus together to announce that nothing had changed. In spite of the arrests and the shift in campus opinion, the administration refused to budge on policy. It seemed the only concession was not to pursue student conduct charges. Finally, Kerr's speech ended.
Right at that moment, Mario and I got up, and he was going to run up to the stage, and I said to him, no, just walk. We'll just walk. And we walked up to the stage.
Mario calmly and slowly approached the mic after the meeting was adjourned.
And he got up and he was standing in front of the microphone. And all he wanted to do was make the announcement of what I just said. And police came out, grabbed him by the throat.
The police have got Mario away. They're putting him away.
And dragged him off the stage. Pandemonium broke out among the thousands of people on the Greek Theater.
That, in front of 15,000 students and faculty packed in the Greek Theater, is symbolic of what's going on here. It's like we're in a police state where they're gagging the leader of the free speech movement. And a lot of the faculty felt after that, that this administration is not capable of resolving this crisis.
The very next day, Faculty Senate held their pivotal meeting. More than 900 faculty were present, the largest turnout in recent memory. While faculty didn't have the authority to change campus policy, establishing their support or opposition to the FSM would be crucial. The administration had lost the support of thousands of students, and they couldn't stand to lose the support of faculty too. A sound system was rigged up on campus to broadcast the discussion and speeches by faculty members.
We didn't know how it would play out, but we knew that the faculty was crucial. That was the thing. And the faculty that had supported us up until that point had been the younger faculty, mostly. But we just knew that the faculty was absolutely crucial to what was going to happen next.
The Faculty Senate was set to vote on a written resolution which would establish faculty support for the following three principles. First, the university should under no circumstances regulate the content of speech. Second, the university can only regulate the time, place, and manner of speech so as not to interfere with university functions, but no further. Third, any student discipline related to speech would be handled by faculty and not administration.
We were all outside, and they, as you said, they were broadcasting the debate. The faculty was virtually, at that time, all white and all male. There was one woman on the faculty. You have to think about that, you know, in that time period. And many of them were older white men. And they're in all these different disciplines and fields and so on. And the speeches were eloquent. The speeches were just tremendously moving in defense of the First Amendment. I was at night, and then they took the vote, and it was announced what the vote was, which was 824 in favor of the free speech movement and 115 opposed. And that was just, that's just an overwhelming vote. I mean, that's not even close. And then the faculty filed out, and it was just a tremendous moment because, first of all, we didn't know what to do, and they started to come out, and then we parted. So we formed an aisle for them, and we were applauding. And many of them were crying. You could see the tears coming down because they had lived through the McCarthy period. They had lived through the loyalty oaths. And we broke the back of that. At that moment, it broke the back of McCarthyism and of the loyalty oaths and affirmed the Constitution of the United States.
In a very short span of time, the tide had almost entirely turned in favor of the FSM.
Student leaders and teaching assistants called a massive strike and the university ground to a halt. 2 days later, the faculty voted 8-1 in favor of student goals. In a student election held during the crisis, free speech candidates swept the field.
But the final decision about what would happen next and whether any policies would actually change depended on the Board of Regents, the same people who made the rules in the first place. That's after the break. Within just 2 weeks, the FSM had entirely changed the tone on campus. With such overwhelming support from faculty, it was inevitable that the Board of Regents would change policy. Here's Robert Cohen.
Usually student movements lose on campus issues, or they have to compromise or something. To actually win, you have to stand up. There's the police, there's the power of suspension, expulsion, there's your own academic career. It's like a David and Goliath struggle. How often does David win? So that's part of why it was so important.
When students returned from winter break, they found that the UC Berkeley chancellor had been replaced. The exact rules around speech were settled over the following semester. But by that point, the debates were over small matters. It was clear that the FSM had won. All political speech, up to and including by communists, would be allowed at any place, at any time, so long as it did not disrupt the operations of the college.
And so essentially what this did was it paved the way for the ending of that whole era. Instead of looking at students as children who need guidance, like a parent to take them care of them, they're more citizens with rights.
It's been more than 60 years since this story took place. Very few of us have been around long enough to remember life before the 60s. What the FSM was demanding seems relatively commonplace today. But it was radical and controversial in 1964.
And that was all something the Black student movement was demonstrating as well. How can you treat students as children when they're risking their lives to fight racism, or they're willing to go to jail to win freedom of speech?
And the victory of the FSM changed the tide all across the country.
We toured the country, Mario and myself and a few other people, and spoke on campuses, Wisconsin, Harvard, Queens College in New York. And we were met by thousands of students cheering. And that changed the regulations everywhere.
And while nobody could have anticipated it then, the timing of this victory would have a huge impact on the future of the country.
The timing of it is just before the United States escalates in Vietnam. And all through the 20th century, impossible to organize against war during wartime. You're going to go to jail for that. Campus is not going to allow it.
Remember, the silent generation.
What happened because of the free speech movement was just before the sort of normal repression is going to come by because you're mobilizing for war, you have this great expansion of free speech on campus. I don't want to exaggerate it. It was uneven in the South and all that in some campuses, but a lot of administrators saw what happened at Berkeley and they had the opposite reaction. Like, in other words, don't restrict speech because you might have another Berkeley, and we don't want another Berkeley here. So that created a different kind of power dynamic than existed before, because students were powerless generally in university. And now, because of this use of mass protest and mass civil disobedience, students now had a kind of power or potential power that opened up a door, expanded freedom. And so that freedom then made possible a mass student movement against the war in Vietnam.
The ripples caused by this one semester at Berkeley stretched on for years and reached far beyond the borders of campus or even California. In 1970, President Nixon established the President's Commission on Campus Unrest, nicknamed the Scranton Commission. The commission was tasked with investigating the rise of campus dissent, particularly following the fatal police shootings at Kent and Jackson State of student protesters. They went so far as to call the then unique form of protest in the 60s, quote, the Berkeley invention. Here's Robert reading from a summary of that report.
The commission left no doubt as to the free speech movement's importance, referring to militant student protests of the 1960s as, quote, the Berkeley invention. What happened at Berkeley was an authentic political invention, a new and complex mixture of issues, tactics, emotions, and setting that became the prototype for student protests throughout the decade. Nothing quite like it had ever before appeared in America. And by the way, these are no friends of student protests. You know, mostly they didn't like student protests, but they're saying this had a huge impact.
But the impact wasn't all positive as far as student speech goes. The overwhelming victory of Berkeley students also led to a political backlash, just as the success of the 1934 general strike did. That's the general strike that led to the rules prohibiting speech that the FSM was fighting so hard against in the first place. Now there was a new generation of politicians ready to lead the backlash.
Candidates like Reagan and later Nixon and Agnew all used this kind of hostility to student protest. And so the free speech movement inadvertently strengthened the new right because it helped Reagan, aside from demagoguing about the Watts riots, he pledged to clean up the mess at Berkeley. And that helped to carry him to a landslide victory over Edmund Brown in the 66 gubernatorial race.
Once in office, Governor Reagan asked for the dismissal of UC Berkeley President Clark Kerr because of the perception that he had been too weak in his response to the FSM. As for the FSM organizers themselves, Mario passed away in November 1996 from a heart attack. He and Bettina had gotten very close during their years as student organizers and stayed lifelong friends. So his death was a blow.
His death was devastating for me. It was a devastating loss. And probably the first really sustained loss that I experienced in my life.
But his name lives on in the Berkeley campus today. The steps of Sproul Hall can now officially be reserved for rallies and speeches under the name the Mario Savio Steps. It goes without saying that a lot has changed in the last 60 years, especially when it comes to speech on campus. I asked Robert, with his historical knowledge, how he looks back on this story through the lens of today.
It was simple back then. The issue then was repression versus freedom. Later in the 60s, the issue was like war criminality versus free speech. In other words, should Dow Chemical be able to come out to campus to recruit people for that corporation when the corporation is making napalm that's killing little children in Vietnam? And so people would say, look, free speech is important, but it's bourgeois, it's not as important as stopping these war crimes. And critical race theorists feel the same way about, well, we like free speech, but we don't want to have bigots coming out the campus making students of color feel badly. It's a much tougher choice the people facing, especially as the right becomes more militant and ugly and fascistic. What 64 kind of reminds us that you can use freedom of speech to stop an unjust war. How many lives were saved because campuses had the freedom to help launch a mass anti-war movement? I think it's thousands. It could be a million. You know, who knows when we would have pulled out of Vietnam? So this is really a life and death matter. and it deserves serious thought. But who's going to understand that? Who's going to teach that? Students don't get taught this in high school. And it would be really good if students today were to think about that. What is the implication of silencing somebody you disagree with? Then you could be silenced, right? I don't think it's fair exactly to say, oh, kids today, they're not as good as they were in 64. They had a simpler kind of choice to make. But I still think the principles that they were articulating are very important. And if you don't think about free speech in a principled way, it's going to come back to haunt you.
If you've got a story idea, we would love to hear about it. Send us an email at campusfilespod@gmail.com. And if you're loving this podcast, be sure to click follow on your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode. While you're there, leave us a review and a 5-star rating. Campus Files is an Odyssey original podcast hosted by Margot Gray and Ian Mont. Our executive producers are Leah Reese-Dennis and Lloyd Lockridge. Campus Files is produced by Ian Mont and Margot Gray. Sound design and engineering by Andy Jaskowitz and Zach Clark. Legal support by Laura Berman and Melissa Jean. Original music by Davey Sumner. Special thanks to Maura Curran, Josephina Francis, Hilary Schuff, Eric Donnelly, Kate Hutchison-Rose, Sean Cherry, Kurt Courtney, and Lauren Vieira.
Drink up, baby. Fantasy Football Happy Hour is here to get you wins and have some laughs. Matthew Berry here, and my podcast, Fantasy Football Happy Hour, has the sleepers, busts, and starts and advice you need to win your league. We're diving into the tape, we're crunching the numbers to bring you sleepers, busts, weekly starts and advice. Whether you're defending a title or desperately avoiding last place, I've got you covered every single weekday. The bar is open. It's Fantasy Football Happy Hour with Matthew Berry, wherever you get your podcasts.